We come now on Friday morning here at the Californian Camp 1982 to the 27th presentation on the Book of Revelation. Let's turn back now to the message to the Church of Thyatira. And last night we were giving some consideration to the presentation of Jesus Christ to the people of that age and period when such tremendous darkness reigned over the entire world. Our verse was Revelation 2 and verse 18. Now very obviously, of course, when one begins to consider the revelation of Jesus Christ as the Son of God, one is treading on the borders of an inexhaustible study theme. And I wouldn't even begin to pretend to cover the fullness of what those words mean, the presentation of Jesus Christ as the Son of God, in the limited time frame of this camp meeting, and of course, in the limited capacities of myself to give and of all of us to receive all we might understand in regard to this presentation. I would just like to emphasize, as I curb somewhat our instincts to plunge into this theme more deeply, I'd just like to emphasize, of course, that the presentation of the gospel of Jesus Christ, which of course involved Jesus Christ as Son of God and Son of Man, is, always has been, and always will be the perfect answer to the man of sin. Now, we've all come from the Seventh-day Adventist Church organization or from the world, and as we perfectly well know from our study of the Laodicean message, when back in 1859 the Spirit of God solemnly declared to the prophets that the Laodicean message applied to God's people at that point of time. Now, that being so, the church then was destitute of the gold, the white raiment, and the eye salve. When we get to the Laodicean message over in Arkansas, not here, I can't see us getting that far today and tomorrow, but I do plan to continue in Arkansas where we leave off at this camp meeting, so if you get both sets of tapes, you'll get a little more than if you came here alone. There'll be one way of covering this book without sacrificing too much of the depth and breadth of these very wonderful presentations, of these wonderful messages. When we come to the Laodicean message, we'll read those statements from Volume 1, and we'll look very closely at the fact that the church, being destitute of gold, did not have that faith and love which brings justification by faith, and therefore did not possess the white raiment, which is the righteousness of Jesus Christ, and was blind both to their own condition and to the saving and beautiful truths that God has for us in His Word. Now, these things being so, they naturally were destitute of the gospel of Jesus Christ, and being destitute of the gospel of Jesus Christ, did not see the revelation of the Son of God as He really is. Now, because of this, the presentations given to the world were lacking that living fire, that life and power which would bring true conversion to men's hearts, and people joined the church organization instead of being joined to Jesus Christ Himself. And I remember with great distinctness when the message first came to me back in 1955, I had been for many, many years as a member and then as a worker in the Seventh-day Adventist Church without ever experiencing real deliverance from the bondage of sin. And I remember how complacently the church moved along, unruffled and undisturbed, until the gospel of Jesus Christ began to be proclaimed in her ranks. And Jesus Christ as Son of God and Son of Man was the great theme of our contemplation. And those of you who've been in this movement since its earliest days, the first time I came to America was back in 1964, and there were two people in this audience who took the message that year. The next time was 65, and there were several other families who joined then. But most of you, of course, have joined since that point of time and were not participants in those early controversies. But what was it that to us was the answer to the apostasy and Laodicean coldness of those days? It was the revelation of Jesus Christ as the Son of God. Isn't that true? For those of us who are there. And today, what is the great keeping message which separates us from the world and prepares us for the soon coming struggle against the beast in His image? The revelation of Jesus Christ as the Son of God. And so it ever will be. And therefore we cannot overemphasize the necessity for us individually to know Him in that role as Son of God and Son of Man, and to have the mystery of the incarnation reproduce their own life experience. That just as through marriage to the human race and the implantation of divine seed by the awesome power of the Holy Spirit, who is the seed implanter, Jesus Christ came into this world, so we too are likewise, through the implantation of Christ, the divine seed, by the almighty power of the Holy Spirit, we are to have the mystery of the incarnation repeated in our own experience. Paul calls this in Colossians, the first chapter, the mystery of God, which is Christ in you, the hope of glory. That is the mystery of God. And it's that mystery which is to be finished during the time when the seventh angel shall sound, as you read in Revelation chapter 10. Until the work is finished and the people of God at last are ready to go home and be with him in the kingdom. So I'll do no more this morning than to emphasize the importance of that truth and leave you to explore, as I hope you will do in other areas of Revelation chapter 1 and 2, as a result of these means, into deeper depths of those things, with special reference to what that revelation of Jesus Christ, the Son of God, means to you personally. Now it goes on to say in verse 18, who hath his eyes like unto a flame of fire. I turn to the book Education, page 16, and we find that we have a very helpful comment here on this particular expression. Sister White has a vision of Jesus Christ coming in the clouds of heaven, and this is so beautiful. I'll go back to the previous page, page 15 of the book Early Writings, and they will read this glorious description of the coming of Jesus Christ. Soon our eyes were drawn to the east, where a small black cloud had appeared, about half as large as a man's hand, which we all knew was a sign of the Son of Man. We all, in solemn silence, gazed on the cloud as it grew nearer and became lighter, glorious, and still more glorious, till it was a great white cloud. The bottom appeared like fire. The rainbow was over the cloud, while round it were 10,000 angels singing a most lovely song, and upon it sat the Son of Man. His hair was white and curly and lay on his shoulders, and upon his head were many crowns. His feet had the appearance of fire, in his right hand was a sharp sickle, in his left a silver trumpet. And there comes the comment on the part of the verse we're looking at together in Revelation 2. His eyes were as a flame of fire which searched his children through and through. Then all faces gathered paleness, and those that God had rejected gathered blackness. Then we all cried out, "Who shall be able to stand? Is my robe spotless?" Then the angels ceased to sing, and there was some time of awful silence when Jesus spoke. "Those who have clean hands and pure hearts shall be able to stand. My grace is sufficient for you." At this our faces lighted up, and joy filled every heart. And the angel struck a note higher and sang again, while the cloud grew still nearer the earth. Now these eyes, which are as a flame of fire, indicates that Jesus Christ has the capacity to search his children through and through. In other words, what is he able to read? The real person underneath any facade or mask which might be put on the outside. He is able to penetrate beneath the surface and see the deepest recesses of the soul and to know just what kind of person that person is. Now, why do you suppose Jesus Christ with this capacity was a necessary and comforting revelation for the people back in the days of the Thyatiran church? It was because never at any other time has hypocrisy and counterfeit religion so fully been used to disguise and cover the real evil underneath. In the great controversy, for instance, in the chapter dealing with the message in France, the Reformation in France, the statement which says that the priests and prelates and the kings and so forth greatly affected the courtesies and graces of the Christian experience. I don't think I can find the statement quickly, but perhaps I should try, because I haven't got the words exactly right, and they're worth seeing in their exact context. I'll just have a very quick look here, although I don't think I can find as quickly as I'd like to. But the statement does, of course, give to us the realization that a great deal of hypocrisy, artificiality, a great deal of covering up of the real nature of the sinfulness underneath was practiced by the people of that time. I don't see it quickly, actually. It's in a chapter I know called The French Reformation, which begins about page 212 or 13 or thereabouts. The French Reformation, which of course was an abortive reformation because the powers that be were successful in destroying those who held true to the faith of Jesus. There was, of course, the fearful massacre of Bartholomew's Day, which was one of the most terrible slaughters of God's people that was ever undertaken by the Romanists. Okay, I can't find it very quickly here, I'm sorry, but that's the sense of the sentence, which says that the priests and Pilates greatly affected the graces of Christianity, made it look as if they were true Christians, but underneath, of course, they were absolutely ravening wolves, the worst kind of people that you could possibly imagine. And being that, many people were deceived by their apparent sanctity without realizing, of course, the real nature of the person beneath. Now, no doubt, the reformers of the Dark Ages, men like Martin Luther, Calvin, Huss, Jerome, Zwingli, Melanchthon, and the English reformers such as Wycliffe and so on, they were able to see the perfidy, the deception, the hypocrisy of these leaders, and were seriously affected with sorrow and disappointment. Many of the weaker members of the church could not see the difference, and not being able to, were led astray by the lies and deception and apparent sincerity and Christianity of those leaders. Now, don't be deceived, of course, because always you will find that those people who lead out in false doctrines are the models very often of gentleness and peaceableness and kindness and love and so forth. And very often they may even show up the people of God in an unfavorable light, because it will appear that they are not so Christian and so sincere as those who are purveyors of false doctrines. We must learn to measure a person not by their character or by their apparent character, but by the message which they teach. And we spent some time, of course, dwelling upon that thought earlier in the week. Very often the people of God, being still in the immature stage, still being newborn children, don't have the experience to cope with some of these serious problems, and they may do something which puzzle others, until it is realized, of course, that in the spiritual stage they're still children and don't quite know how to handle these more difficult situations. And so then, to the leaders and the people back in the Thyatira period, the realization that Jesus could read the true nature of the hypocrites was indeed a very great and precious comfort to them. And knowing that Jesus Christ had this capacity and that he was their problem solver, they knew they could go to him and ask very pertinent questions about how they should relate to people who professed to be Christians but who in fact were not. Now, of course, this is something which we find a necessity in each of these groups. Back in the church of Ephesus, the Lord approved of their having tested and found the false apostles to be liars. We also find the same thing, if I remember correctly, in the Pergamos period. And now we find that Jesus Christ appears with that same capacity here in the Thyatira period. Now, we could now, of course, turn our attention to many statements, especially those in connection with the judgment of the dead and of the living, which tell us in very solemn terms that even though we may think that our evil deeds are hidden from the eyes of husbands, wives, parents, children, friends, or fellow church members, every thought and word and deed and action of our lives is known to God and to the angel scribes. And the faithful record is kept of these things, and the day will come, of course, when they'll all be brought to light, and what Jesus now sees with those eyes, like unto a flame of fire, will be seen by all the world around about us as well. As Jesus said, what you do in secret will be proclaimed from the housetops, and the world will know it. Certainly, of course, God's repentant people will have protection from such exposure, but those who maintain outwardly a religious practice or performance, but inwardly are maintaining a life of sin, will find themselves exposed in due time by the circumstances which shall arise. And then imagine the shame and contempt of that fearful day. For homework on this particular subject, I would suggest you read the chapter in the book Great Controversy called The Investigative Judgment. And perhaps I'll just read a paragraph from that chapter to give a sample of what the chapter is mostly all about. It's a chapter which deals with the with the work of the great high priest in searching out the lives of the people of God. It's called Facing Life's Record in this particular edition, but in other great controversies it's called The Investigative Judgment. It starts on page 479, and I turn across now to page 486, and I'll just read one or two paragraphs here to highlight the capacity of Jesus Christ to see to the innermost depths of a person's soul, so nothing hidden or deceptive can remain unseen. Sins which have not been repented of and forsaken will not be pardoned and blotted out of the book of record, but will stand to witness against the sinner in the day of God. He may have committed his evil deeds in the light of day or in the darkness of night, but they were open and manifest before him with whom we have to do. Now that little sentence, "they were open and manifest before him with whom we have to do," instantly reminds me of the statement in Revelation 2 verse 18, "who hath eyes like unto a flame of fire." Now am I correct in relating these two statements? Am I? Certainly. Angels of God witnessed each sin and registered it in the unerring records. Sin may be concealed, denied, covered up from father, mother, wife, children, and associates. No one but the guilty actors may cherish the least suspicion of the wrong that is laid bare before the intelligences of heaven. The darkness of the darkest night, the secrecy of all deceptive arts, is not sufficient to veil one thought from the knowledge of the eternal. God has an exact record of every unjust account and every unfair dealing. He is not deceived by appearances of piety. He makes no mistakes in his estimation of character. Men may be deceived by those who are corrupt in heart, but God pierces all disguises and reads the inner life. How solemn is the thought, day after day, passing into eternity, bears its burden of records for the books of heaven. Words once spoken, deeds once done, can never be recalled. Angels have registered both the good and the evil. The mightiest conqueror upon the earth cannot call back the record of even a single day. Our acts, our words, even our most secret motives, all have their weight in deciding our destiny for weal or woe. Though they may be forgotten by us, they will bear their testimony to justify or condemn. As the features of the countenance are reproduced with unerring accuracy upon the polished plate of the artist, so the character is faithfully delineated in the books above. Yet how little solicitude is felt concerning that record which is to meet the gaze of heavenly beings. Could the veil which separates the visible from the invisible world be swept back, and the children of men behold an angel recording every word and deed which they must meet again in the judgment, how many words that are daily uttered would remain unspoken, how many deeds would remain undone. And so we might read on, but I'll leave you to that for your homework. Those words, of course, giving to us a very clear picture that Jesus Christ does indeed have eyes like unto a flame of fire, and there is absolutely nothing hidden from his sight. Now this should cause us, on the one hand, of course, a sense of care, but on the other hand, a sense of great rejoicing. Because when we go back to heaven, both we and the angels will be deeply concerned that not the slightest germ or seed or virus of sin will have found entrance therein. And therefore we need a judge, a scrutiny with the capacity to detect the last tiny little seed or virus of sin and to refuse it entrance into the kingdom of heaven. Now today, of course, we live in the age of aircraft hijacking, and no longer can you board an aircraft without being searched. Your baggage is subjected to an X-ray machine, and they run gauges over your body to make sure you don't have any weapons on your person. But every now and again, someone gets through by carefully concealing explosives or perhaps weapons of some kind on their person or in their baggage. And careful as the detectors may be, they don't find those things soon enough to prevent their going on board and causing a hijacking. It would be nice to know, as you board an aircraft, that the capacity of the scrutineers was such that nothing could get past them. That we don't have this assurance. But we do have the assurance that Jesus Christ has the capacity to ensure that nothing sinful or evil will get past him and therefore cannot find its way back into heaven again to spring up and bear another harvest of evil fruit. And isn't that good news? Absolutely. We don't want sin back in heaven. That place must remain completely unscarred and unstained by its presence. And we recognize, of course, that it only takes one germ lodged in a favorable environment to multiply at enormous speed to become a great and fearful and destructive disease. Now, at the same time, we can also rejoice because Jesus Christ has the capacity to search us out and to reveal to us our own secret sins, giving to us the privilege and blessing of getting rid of those things. It's any ministry which reveals ourselves to ourselves is a blessed ministry. It's one reason why Paul calls the Ten Commandment law, that ministration of death, a glorious ministration, though less glorious than the ministration of the Spirit, a glorious ministration just the same. And so we have occasion to rejoice that Jesus Christ does have those capacities. Again, I'll leave you to explore that theme to as great a depth as we could do, but it requires time. Now we have the expression, his feet are like fine brass. We're still dealing, of course, with the revelation of Jesus Christ to the Thyatiran church, to the Babylonian church, and that means, of course, a revelation to you and me, because, as we have come to learn, we still have not entirely escaped from where? From Babylon, have we? We've learned a lot, we've come a long way, but I still believe there's still a further cleansing work to do before our separation from Babylon is totally complete. We've learned from chapter 1 that feet like unto fine brass indicate a glorified humanity, which Jesus Christ personally possesses. But we also know that implicit in that statement, that he today possesses a glorified humanity, implicit in that statement is the obvious fact that to obtain that glorified humanity, he had to come down and obtain a sinful humanity first of all. Because unless he'd come down to obtain a sinful humanity, he could not have gone back to possess a glorified humanity at all. He could only have had a glorified angel's nature, but not a glorified humanity. Because before the glorified humanity, there had to be sinful humanity. There had to be. Now, as I said last night, and I'll just mention the point again, the basis of Roman Catholic teaching is that Jesus Christ came in what kind of flesh and blood? Sinless or glorified flesh and blood. In their theology, there is no sinful humanity preceding sinless humanity. Now, the people then of in the Dark Ages, as much also the people of today, needed a revelation of a Savior with a glorified humanity possessed only because, first of all, he had a sinful humanity. If we think, of course, of the great doctrine of Antichrist and the answer to it, that revelation of Jesus Christ becomes self-evident. Let's move on now to verse 23. And here again we'll find a further revelation of Jesus Christ, which is very much like unto that which we have previously looked at in verse 18. And I will kill her children with death, and all the churches shall know that I am he which searcheth the reins and hearts, and I will give unto every one of you according to your works. Now, does anyone know what word reigns really is? The word reigns seems to be something of a mistranslation. Mind? Did you say mind? Well, Young's says kidneys. That may sound very surprising until we understand why in just a moment or two. But we have the reference reigns in Young's Concordance. And there's a reference from Isaiah 11, verse 5, and faithfulness, the girdle of his reins. In this case, it's translated loins from the Greek, from the Hebrew word. But in all the following references, with no exceptions, including especially Revelation 2, verse 23, it is translated kidneys or reins. Job 16, Psalms, Proverbs, Jeremiah, Lamentations, and finally down into Revelation 2 and verse 23. We find the references to kidneys. So therefore, the verse is really saying in Revelation 2, verse 23, and all the churches shall know that I am he which searches the kidneys and hearts. And when you turn to the word kidneys, further back in the same book, of course, we don't find, I don't think this is translated reins anywhere, it's just straight kidneys. But yes, the word kidneys is also here translated reins from kelioth, is the original Hebrew word, whereas reins themselves, likewise from kelioth. So in the Bible, the original Hebrew word kelioth, and I guess I mispronounced it, but never mind, is translated either kidneys or reins, either way. Now, when you go back to the Old Testament sanctuary service, a sacrifice, a lamb, a goat, or a bullock, had to be absolutely flawless. We know this, of course. And before the sacrifice was made, the sacrificial animal was inspected from nose to tail, looking for defects, for scars, for crippled limbs, for any indication that the animal was in bad condition or shape. And when you read through the various sacrifices of the Old Testament, you find that the kidneys are mentioned again and again and again together with the heart. And I understand, I haven't quite found the reference yet, but I understand that a further inspection was made after the animal was killed. They weren't satisfied with the external inspection. There also had to be an internal inspection. And if the heart was found to be scarred or deformed, and if the kidneys were found to be likewise scarred or deformed, the sacrifice, even though it had already been killed, was still rejected. Now, there are many statements in the Spirit of Prophecy, or a number of statements at least. I don't have any of my fingertips right now, but I've read them, and I know you have too, which tell us that this inspection of those ancient sacrifices was a lesson to the Hebrews and to us that God is not prepared to accept a defective sacrifice upon our part. Now, this doesn't mean, of course, that every last word and deed that we utter must be absolutely perfect from babyhood up. God understands the days of our ignorance, and He recognizes the growth process, and He gives us time to learn the great lessons. But the kind of defective sacrifice that the Lord is talking about is that given by Ananias and Sapphira, when they wittingly and knowingly made a total consecration of their means to God, and then, after they had sold their properties, decided to withhold a certain portion for themselves, while at the same time still pretending to give the entire money to the Lord. And when we do things that deliberately defect or make defective our ministry for God, then of course we are bringing to God a defective sacrifice which God certainly cannot accept. Now, during the Middle Ages, during the time of papal supremacy, what kind of sacrifices in the religious profession were the papists bringing to Christ? Defective? Very much so. They made great pretense of giving all to God, whereas in actual fact they were bent on gathering all to themselves. So their practice never matched their profession. Now, once again, of course, we have the thought that while the average person could not penetrate this deception, Jesus Christ did. He recognized the defectiveness of their offering and rejected that offering because of its defectiveness. And when the destruction came upon these churches at last, then men would understand that Jesus Christ had searched the reins and the hearts and had rejected their offering because of its defective nature. And that reminds me, of course, of the first several verses back in Isaiah chapter 58, a very familiar passage of Scripture to us. And I don't think we need to take time to read it this morning, but Isaiah 58 is the great medical missionary chapter. We read in verse 3, or even verse 2 and 3, down to verse 7, where the people complained because God had not accepted their sacrifices and their offerings, and they wondered why He had not done this, and God told them why, because they were using religion for a different purpose altogether than that which God Himself had designed. Now come down to verse 24 in chapter 2, and we'll now read further counsel that God gave to those people. But unto you I say, and unto the rest in Thyatira, as many as have not this doctrine, and which have not known the depths of Satan as they speak, I will put upon you none other burden, but that which you have already, hold fast till I come. Now, here God is addressing Himself specifically to those who during the Thyatiran period had not partaken of the papal spirits. In the early part, of course, this would come to the Waldenses, the Albigenses and their friends and compatriots, later to the people in England under Wycliffe, then to the folk in Bohemia under Huss and Jerome, to Martin Luther, and last of all to the Wesleyans. And each of these people progressed, of course, beyond the ground gained by their predecessors. The Waldensians had laid and maintained some very sound foundations. The Lollards under Wycliffe, of course, built upon those foundations, and great progress was made during that period of time. Further progress was made by the Hussites, and then by Luther, and finally by the Wesleyans. But none of them came so far as to understand the ministry of Christ in the heavenly sanctuary, the importance of the seventh day Sabbath over the first day of the week, and many other great and solemn truths in the Word of God. What they did have in common, of course, was the principle of the gospel and the principle that Jesus Christ is, in fact, and indeed the head of the Christian church. As A.T. Jones says in Lesson of the Reformation, those men knew the head of the Christian church. Now, God in His great mercy recognized that because they came out of such tremendous darkness, they couldn't possibly understand all that was to be understood. And He was glad they'd made as much progress as they had. In the book Lesson from the Reformation, I'd like to read the first few little paragraphs on page 216, Lesson from the Reformation, chapter 18, The Reformation and the Sabbath. No fault can ever be found with any of the Reformers because they did not see the true Sabbath of the Fourth Commandment. No one of the Reformers can ever be charged with inconsistency in this. It would be inconsistent for anybody to require or to expect that in their circumstances they should see everything. They were awakened in the deep darkness of the papal nights. They were awakened by a great light, it is true, and that light was the true light. Yet even then they could not be expected to see everything. They could not see everything at once and could not live long enough to see all. But they did see the fundamental truths. They did see the principles in which everything is embraced, in which lies all that should ever follow. And they were perfectly consistent in these principles. Indeed, it is marvelous how clearly and fully they distinguished the divine principles and with what perfect precision in these principles they held the straight course. Those wonderful men can never be too highly honored for what they did. It is not too much to say that without the Reformation the world could not have lived till now. But it is not true honor to the Reformers for those who have come after to see only what they saw and as they saw it, and to hold only what they held and as they held it. For the people to dwell in and have the full benefit of all the light that broke upon the world by the Reformers and not see more than they saw is to see less than they saw, to be less than they were, and is to dishonor instead of to honor them. The light of God ever shines more and more onward unto the perfect day. And those who come after must stand in all the light that shone before, and also in the more that shines because of that which has shone before. The Reformers are not in any wise to be held at fault for not seeing the true Sabbath. But when their successors came in as heirs of the Reformation, and Rome picked up that very truth of the Sabbath and brought it home to them and spread it out before their eyes and laid it down at their feet, then these were decidedly and guiltily inconsistent not to follow up the fundamental principles of the Reformation and the acceptance of that truth. And when that has ever been continued by Rome and the progress of the Reformation has been repeated by others over and over, these today are still more inconsistent with the spirit of truth. They still more dishonor the Reformers and deny the Reformation when they refuse to accept God's Sabbath and honor Him and the Reformation by the observance of it. Now, A.T. Jones states the principle very, very clearly and plainly there and comments in effect upon the words of God in Revelation 2, which says, I will put upon you none other burden but that which you have already hold fast till I come. Now, I wonder why God called great truths a burden. I think the idea is the idea of responsibility rather than a load to be carried. Because truth is not a burden in that sense, but it does become a great responsibility and becomes our responsibility to share that truth with other people within the sphere of our divinely appointed influence. And so God understands perfectly well that the light of truth advances from day to day. Now, when we say that today we preach the message of Wagner and Jones, people might tend to ask us, well, I've never read, for instance, the character of God in the writings of A.T. Jones and E.J. Wagner. I've never read there about the Sabbath rest principles. And so you're teaching things that those men never taught. Not really. As A.T. Jones himself said in that particular publication, he would be disappointed today if he was to rise from his grave and come amongst us and find us merely going over and over that which they taught, nothing else but that. What would A.T. Jones expect of us today? Right, you expect us to advance far beyond the point where they were in their day. He expects us to teach what they taught and more than they taught. Because to teach less than they taught, or to teach only what they taught, he would say to us, then you teach less than we taught because you have lost even what we had. Now, Sister White herself, in making a comment upon the messages of Wagner and Jones in the Bible Commentary, Volume 7, and this statement comes to us from Revelation 18, the page is 984, Volume 7 of the Bible Commentary. The time of test is just upon us, for the loud cry of the third angel has already begun in the revelation of the righteousness of Christ, the sin-pardoning Redeemer. This is the beginning of the light of the angel whose glory shall fill the whole earth. So after those men have been preaching for 4 years, from 1888 to 1892, when in a review and held on November 22, Sister White wrote those words, even after 4 years, what had they presented? Only the beginning of the light of the angel whose glory shall fill the whole earth. Now if the Seventh Adventist Church had accepted the beginning of that light, what would they very soon have received? The fullness of it, eventually. They would soon have received the advancing stage and finally have come to the fullness of that light. And as we recognize, those of us who come to camp meeting after camp meeting, year after year, we recognize the fact that the light of truth has been steadily advancing ever since we first accepted it. That the camp meetings are not simply a rehearsal or a rehashing of what we heard last year or the year before and so forth. Certainly great fundamental principles are repeated. But the information that God has given to us is continually advancing and opening up, so we learn more and more as each year goes by. And as we learn more and more, what happens to the old fundamentals? They become brighter and firmer and clearer, more understandable and more powerful. And that is, of course, is as it should be. When we come to that place where we have to say, well, we've got no more new light to share, we have to go back and simply rehash all the old material, then the time will have come for us to be alarmed, concerned and worried, for fear that we have, or in the knowledge, I should better say, that we have now lost our connection with the light giver and have begun to drift into serious apostasy. Or that we have rejected some great truths that God has given to us. But while ever the light marches on, then this movement has not rejected light. It is when light ceases to open up before our minds that we can be sure that somewhere, somehow, we have rejected the light of heaven. I've always noticed that usually when people pick up something which is different from the established belief of the body. Now, I was quite impressed with the statement read yesterday afternoon before the special item, where Sister White says that those who pick up ideas which are different from the general body of the believers whom God is leading, because Sister White says that God is not leading out a person here and there, he is leading out a people or a movement. And she talks about the established faith of the body. Now, usually when people, almost inevitably, when people pick up something which is different from the established faith of the body, eventually they begin to back off from things they once believed themselves previously. And this is always an evidence, of course, that they are on the wrong track and the body is still very much on the right track. So just as God back there gave those wonderful men the great fundamentals and they built upon those fundamentals and that was all that God required of them, so God today has given to us great light and we are to build upon that great light as long as this life shall last and we trust it will last until Jesus comes again. But always and ever the light grows brighter and brighter until the coming day. Truth never stands still. There is unlimited depth to it. Now, I'd like to stress the fact that what we have learned from Revelation 1 and 2 is only but the very beginnings of the depths of truth contained in these two very, very wonderful chapters. And we've really done them thoroughly. You may say, well, you've done them very thoroughly. Not really. I see this almost as a superficial survey of these two chapters. If we've really done them thoroughly, we'd hardly get past the first verse in the first chapter. And that's quite a serious and responsible statement. So there's no limit to the truth of God. It is as infinite as eternity itself. Now time has gone now for